For the record, I intend to work with the readings I chose to explore the theme of peace before Friday's events, but my sermon will take them in a somewhat different direction. The first reading is The Deadline. It's a poem by the great Greek poet of the early 20th century, Konstantin Kafavi of Alexandria, Egypt. It's about the cruel, pleasure-drunk, and totally unconscious Roman Emperor Nero and General Galba, who was to replace Nero as Caesar. The Oracle of Delphi, a shrine dedicated to Apollo, was considered by the vast majority of the ancient authors to be totally authoritative and believable.
Nero shrugged his shoulders when he heard the future that Apollo prophesied. Beware the age of 73. The oracle at Delphi never lied. He took her at her word. Untroubled, he slept on, secure. At 30, he could dedicate his life to pleasure, pure and simple, unperturbed, the deadline more than 40 years away. Jaded, he limps back to Rome, hungover from his trip to Greece, transformed, translated by excess. The actors, races, stadiums, flowing wine, Greek cities sloping to the shore with naked bodies lolling on the beach, stars reflected in the purple sea. So Nero dreams. And meanwhile, on the arid flats of Spain, Galba drills his legions secretly. Galba, a sprightly 73.
And the second reading comes from the Nobel Peace Prize acceptance speech of Rigoberta Menchú Tomé, a Mayan justice worker who received the prize back in the 1990s.
When evaluating the overall significance of the award of the Peace Prize, I would like to say some words on behalf of all those whose voice cannot be heard or who have been repressed for having spoken their opinions, of all those who have been marginalized, who have been discriminated, who live in poverty, in need, of all those who are the victims of repression and violation of human rights, those who nevertheless have endured through centuries, who have not lost their conscience, determination, and hope. Today, it is important to emphasize the deep respect that the Maya civilization had towards nature. Who could predict what other developments these people could have achieved if they had not been conquered by blood and fire and subjected to an ethnocide that affected nearly 50 million people in the course of 500 years?
Thank you.
one of the enduring qualities of the day that we call Sunday, today, is that nothing can stop it from arriving. Nothing. And for ministers like me, Sunday is also inextricably bound up with the great deadline. And you can probably tell that I capitalized those words. 9:15 a.m. and 11 a.m. are juggernauts that careen toward me every single week. I know I have no power to swerve around them, no matter how dissatisfied I might be with what I'm going to say. So, here's the story. We were printing the order of celebration in the office last Friday when the news exploded with the tragic story out of Connecticut. I suppose we could have called Stop the Presses and redesigned the whole service, chosen new readings and so forth, but of course, in case you haven't noticed, I'm only a human being, not some invulnerable Superman. Upon hearing such news, we human beings rather tend to buckle over and bend with shock and confusion and grief and outrage and worry and about 24 other emotions I have yet to name, all of which galloped through the meadow of my body like untamed horses. I had no capacity to rewrite anything. I had no capacity to think or to focus. And anyway, I had already just heard that morning that the great love of my life, as people often call their first and often most head over heels loves, had just died that morning of tragic illness at age 57. We had remained friends over the years and our love never really diminished. We just couldn't be together, that's all. So as a human being, not an invulnerable Superman, grief was already saturating my being. And then that news from Connecticut. But as hours moved on, I realized that I, like every single one of my colleagues, and believe me, we've been talking to each other every hour on the hour all weekend, like all of us, I was going to have to make many changes, throw away many written pages, crumple up 100 notes and toss them in order to arrive at the inevitable Sunday deadline coming my way this week. But then I suddenly realized that I do the same thing every week without Connecticut. I always throw notes away, readings that I thought I liked and then decided I didn't. I throw out sketches for stories, motifs, whole sermons. I write and rewrite, making time even when I have no time. The creative process has never delivered the sermon to me full-blown, on a silver platter. It's always a struggle to find just the right thing to say. To be honest to you, each of you, and all of you, and to be honest to myself at the exact same time, which, if you think about it, is well-nigh impossible, since we're all so unique. So I can't always succeed as I would like, and I know that. In this month, where the theme has been peace, I would like to say again what I suggested last week, namely that peace, be it world peace, peace of mind, peace of heart, is also not a present that arrives full-blown on a silver platter. Peace is always a struggle to achieve and to maintain, and it's never ever going to be perfect. It will never be free from troubles, disappointments, and unexpected events. That would be death, eternal peace, but not on this side of the grave. So what I want you to hear this morning is that I am not complaining about the dreaded deadline of Sunday morning. any Sunday, this Sunday included. The deep struggle it demands of me every single week is my peace. It is my peace, not what comes afterward. There is no other possible way to achieve my sermon except through the creative struggle with its 100 frustrations and disappointments. Any artist, any writer, any teacher, almost anyone I can think of can say the same thing, I suppose. The cost of getting to a deadline on time with an outcome that you can live with is always, always going to be a struggle. Peace has to come before the deadline, not at the end. It's not what comes afterward. That's just rest. But not everyone looks at deadlines the way I do. For a few years now, many of us on the skeptical side of things have been snickering, as exemplified by the breezy quotes I placed on the top of the order in celebration back on Wednesday, about all this talk about the end of the world. The end of the world that experts, and you can put quotation marks out for about 10 feet on the other side, experts claim will take place this coming Friday. The final deadline. The end of the line. Finis. The apocalypse. How do they know this? They claim that the Mayan people, Native Americans in the Central American area, South Mexico and so forth, that the Mayan people predicted this hundreds of years ago. The hype around this has been incredible, especially because the world has already ended so many times. Come up and look at this afterward if you want. It's a list of all the predictions of the end of the world, none of which have come to pass. On this list, you'll find Roman soothsayers, medieval theologians, Reformation radicals, people as responsible and beloved as John Wesley, and as patently ridiculous as that Campion guy whose predictions failed twice within a single year recently. They all, each one of them, gave specific dates for the end of the world, 1890, 1924. 375, 1,200, 1,000, specific dates, all passed. What's a bit strange about all of the folks using the Bible, for instance, to craft their specific predictions is that nowhere in the Western scriptures will you find the phrase, end of the world. Nowhere. You can look all you want, you're not going to find it. You will only find the phrase, the end of the eon. And the word eon is Greek, and it also has kind of migrated over to English, and it means exactly what it means in English. Eon, age, era, time. The end of a certain age, the end of an era. When I called my friend Jane Jepka to tell her that my first love had died, he was a person that she knew, she said right away, the end of an era. She wasn't talking about the sun and the moon falling from the sky. She wasn't talking about the last judgment. She was talking about the importance and the impact of that death in my life. The end of an age. I think this idea of the end of the world, however, so prevalent in the West, of the eternally recurring deadline that the world is going to end, is the deepest and most corrupting rot at the center of our culture. Rot. It is the corruption at the center of the stupendous violence found everywhere, found in every blockbuster where the former governor of California gleefully killed scores of people, wanting us to root for him all the way with a wink in his eye, to the Western shoot-em-ups of my youth, good guys and bad guys, no one in the middle, all the way to a surprising percentage of modern video games where you use guns to shoot images of people and make them die, even though they're just images. I'm not talking about hunting here, hunting guns. I'm talking about guns designed for murdering human beings and only for murdering human beings, which seems to have happened a lot around here recently, in the last couple of years. The United States of America is known throughout the world for its frequent shooting incidents, especially in the last couple of years. We stand out. We are unique among the nations of the world. And we're also known for saying, who, us? And so instead of looking at the murderous apocalyptic rot at the center of our culture, we will find ways to scapegoat perpetrators with the explain-it-away tactics of focusing on mental illness, help for which is routinely gouged out of every state budget I can think of, including ours, maybe even especially ours. This way we can say that apocalyptic murderous rot is not at the center of our culture, but only in the distorted brains of loner perpetrators. Listen to the words now of the Canadian womanist blogger who always teaches me a great deal. Renee Martin is her name. She writes, as I watched CNN yesterday and learned about the shooting in Connecticut, I was absolutely horrified. The more I watched, the more anxious I was for my children to return home so that I could hug them, so that I could kiss them, a luxury that 20 sets of parents and extended families no longer have. As we held our sons and told them how much we loved them, several things struck my mind. Watching the news, there has been a lot of discussion of the role that mental health had to play. Whenever these shootings happen, the media goes on yet another round, stigmatizing those who are mentally ill. Few will acknowledge that those who are neurologically atypical are more prone to harm themselves than others. And instead, we get warnings of how we have to deal with the mentally ill in society better. Yes, people need access to good mental health treatment. They do. But not because they might go out and kill someone, but because healthcare, regardless of the reason, should simply be a human right. What people who are disabled do not need is yet another round of pathologizing commentary. Dr. Drew and the like have no idea what Adam Lanza's motivation really was, or if he was indeed mentally ill, but they have no problem repeatedly saying this. Neurologically typical people perform horrible, heinous acts every damn day, but when horrible incidents like this happen, you're never going to hear about that. Which is exactly what Rigoberta Menchú, a Mayan, was saying when she described the death of millions of her people. Physical death, conquest, and now even their revered culture. For you see, the famous Mayan calendar does indeed talk about an end of an age, an end of an era, the end of an eon, a time, but nowhere, just as with the Bible, will you find the idea of the end of the world. White men, without a drop of Mayan blood, swaggering, smirking blabbermouths, have been making a fortune writing books and making TV shows about the coming Mayan apocalypse this Friday, knowing full well that the Mayan calendar says no such thing. The people who do this do not have a diagnosis. They are typical, not atypical, as perhaps Mr. Lanza may indeed have been. I simply don't know. But I do know that UU theologian Rebecca Parker makes good sense to me when she says that the apocalypse is already behind us. It's already behind us, not ahead of us. After two world wars, the Shoah, or the Holocaust, gulags, Korea, Vietnam, warfare in the Balkans and the Middle East, racial and sexual violence, compulsory poverty, bloody uprisings, Katrina, Sandy, and a couple of dozen of shootings of children in the last 100 years. How is it possible to imagine that the apocalypse is to come, is ahead of us? Parker writes elegantly, if we can imagine that the apocalypse is not ahead of us, but already behind us, consider how we might regard our religious task differently. Our religious task, to take seriously the clarity of purpose offered us by deadlines. Not the deadline of you or me writing a sermon, but the deadline of taking seriously that this is our life. The world is not going to end with a bang or with a whimper, or be judged on the plain of Armageddon. And that if you want to be serious about this insight, then we have work to do. To build a world where the shootings we have been experiencing are diminished and don't happen as often, or at all, hopefully, where everyone has a chance, where cultures are preserved, not destroyed, or even worse, sometimes distorted, where answers are not given at once, but contemplated with care, mindful of the consequences that you can answer before the questions are all asked, and that's a problem. Where work of our justice action ministry in alleviating compulsory poverty or working with women's health issues or with the farm workers is taken seriously as part of our religious duty. The end of the world folks are not interested in tasks like that. They seem to wish that the world is going to end so that there's no more need for self-awareness or awareness of farm workers, no more need to build up instead of to tear down. No more difficulties. Poof. All gone. In Kafavi's poem, the Emperor Nero, who ruled the whole world, assumed his death was far off. The oracle had said clearly, beware the age of 73. He didn't have to worry about that deadline, therefore. It was 40 years ahead of him. But the oracle of Delphi's story proclaims instead that all life is interconnected. It's not about us. It's about all of us. And that the deadline was real, and it belonged to Galba, aged 73, not to Nero. Galba, the Caesar who replaced the cruel and bloody Nero, who died at age 31. Nero, self-absorbed, thinking everything was about him, had no interest in interdependence or in making the world of his day more just, more kind, or more open. Those who focus on the end of the world instead of focusing on building up the world are not any different from Nero. The world will be destroyed and they will be saved. It's all about them, just like it was for Nero. Those of us who are living on the other side of the apocalypse, to use Rebecca's image, also have a deadline. Guess what? It's right now. It's not 73 years off. It's not next Sunday at 9:15 or 11. But right now. Right now is the time, even as we all grieve and struggle with the horror of the week, to commit to building up instead of tearing down. To commit to making the world safer, if not perfectly safe, to slowly ridding ourselves of the rot at the center of our culture, the apocalyptic rot that blesses violence as a form of fun and lifts up the idea of a divided world, the saved and the damned, without any embarrassment at all or ethical squirming. Again, I say it, the deadline is now. Just as when I struggle to find clarity while preparing my sermons by using the deadline to energize me, I pray we can use the deadline of now to energize us as we work to clarify the amazing sense of peace we will know, not when the struggle is over, but during it. Or in the words of the Pope Wu, the Popol Vuh, the Mayan book of the people, the time has come now for the dawn, for work to be completed, for those who nourish and sustain us to appear, the enlightened, the civilized people, the time has come for the appearance of humanity on the surface of the earth.